From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Anthony Shadid was sitting in his room at the Baghdad Sheraton earlier this month when he found out he had won the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting for his stories on the war and its aftermath. Shadid is the Islamic Affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. He returned home from Iraq last week and is beginning a six-month leave of absence during which he plans to write a book about Iraq. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Shadid about reporting from Iraq. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Brett Lott's new novel, A Song I Knew by Heart. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Fighting has erupted in Fallujah after the passing of a deadline for insurgents in the Iraqi city to hand over their heavy weapons. There are reports of explosions and fires. NPR's Philip Reeves reports from Baghdad.
The U.S. had been talking about holding joint patrols with Iraqis in Fallujah, but that for now appears to have been overtaken by events. Reports speak of explosions and gunfire in the city, a stronghold of Sunni resistance to the occupation. They say there's been intense fighting in the northern Jalan district, where the insurgents are believed to be concentrated. Flames were seen rising from a building. The U.S. wants the insurgents to disarm. It also wants those who killed and mutilated four Americans last month. As fighting surged anew between U.S. Marines and insurgents, UN envoy Lakhdar Brahimi was pressing the case for a peaceful solution. He told the UN Security Council the violence could lead to a very bloody confrontation with lasting consequences. Philip Reeves, NPR News, Baghdad.
Syrian officials say police fought today with gunmen who staged an attack in a diplomatic quarter of Damascus. The BBC's Kim Gaddis reports from neighboring Lebanon.
Syrian state television has reported that security forces have clashed with what it called a terrorist group, adding that the terrorists had fired indiscriminately at the police. The state television statement added that security forces were now in control of the situation, but gave no further details. At least 3 to 5 explosions were heard in western Damascus early in the evening. Heavy gunfire followed the blasts, which security sources in Damascus said appear to have been caused by car bombs.
The BBC's Kim Gaddis reporting from Lebanon. President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney are preparing for their private meetings with the commission investigating the 9/11 attacks. White House spokesman Scott McClellan says the president is doing some background research.
The president will tell it exactly how it happened, and that's why he's going back and looking at materials that were from that time period. Remember, this is some 2.5 to 3 years ago, so he's going back to refresh his memory so that he can provide the commission with an accurate account and as complete account of events as possible.
The president and the vice president are scheduled to talk with the commission together on Thursday. They will not be under oath, and the White House says their answers may not be recorded. Former President Clinton and former Vice President Al Gore testified before the panel under similar conditions. Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 33 points to close at 10,478 in heavy trading of more than 1.5 billion shares. Advancing issues beat declines by a 9-7 margin. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 4 points. It closed at 2032. This is NPR News. The Supreme Court heard arguments today on whether Vice President Dick Cheney should be required to release records from his Energy Policy Task Force. The White House has refused to give up the records, saying that the president would never be able to obtain candid advice if it later has to be made public. A lawyer for the Sierra Club said the records could reveal whether the task force's policy recommendations were unduly influenced by energy industry executives. 4 environmental groups have filed a federal lawsuit to try to protect archaeological sites in Utah from a Bush administration effort to find new sources of natural gas. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Salt Lake City.
The government describes the Nine Mile Canyon area of Utah as containing one of the nation's greatest concentrations of ancient Indian rock art and dwellings. So environmentalists mobilized when the Bush administration announced plans to search for natural gas in adjacent canyons and on a plateau above Nine Mile. Their lawsuit claims that heavy seismic trucks and blast holes used in exploration could damage delicate archaeological features. The Federal Bureau of Land Management says Nine Mile Canyon itself is off limits and that exploration work must stay at least 300 feet away from known archaeological sites. Environmentalists say many sites are unmapped. The work is scheduled to begin in 3 weeks. The lawsuit is a last-ditch attempt to stop it. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
The National Guard says two sisters from a Wisconsin unit have decided not to return to duty in Iraq. Rachel and Charity Whitmer have chosen to accept non-combat jobs elsewhere after Charity's twin, Michelle, was killed in an ambush in Baghdad. Pentagon policy says soldiers may request to leave a war zone if a family member has been killed in combat. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sony Music, presenting Mary Chapin Carpenter's new release, Between Here and Gone, featuring A Beautiful Racket, available at Barnes & Noble booksellers.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Earlier this month, my guest Anthony Shadid won the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting for his articles about Iraq. Shadid is the Washington Post's Islamic Affairs correspondent. He was based in Iraq before the war, remained in Baghdad during the bombing, and then reported on the war's aftermath. Last week, he returned to the U.S. to begin a 6-month leave of absence, during which he plans to write a book about Iraq. The Pulitzer Board cited his, quote, extraordinary ability to capture, at personal peril, the voices and emotions of Iraqis as their country was invaded, their leader toppled, and their way of life upended, unquote. Iraq isn't the first place Shadid has risked his life to cover a story. In 2002, when he was a reporter for the Boston Globe, he was shot and wounded while covering the Israeli incursion in the West Bank town of Ramallah. Before working for the Globe, he was the Middle East correspondent for the Associated Press. Shadid is an American of Lebanese descent who was born in Oklahoma City. He speaks and reads Arabic. Where were you when you heard about the Pulitzer Prize, and how did you hear about it?
I was in my hotel room. We had recently moved into the Sheraton because of some security concerns that we had at our house. So I was at the Sheraton. I just finished the day story, and we knew that I was one of the finalists, so the Post had me on a speakerphone waiting to hear the word, and I was watching the AP wire as the announcement came over. It was then, and it still is, kind of overwhelming, almost bewildering in a way. You're so focused on the work, and then to have recognition like that I think you feel a little undeserving, and then you're just kind of overwhelmed by the reaction that the Pulitzer seems to generate. It was actually nice hearing word of it in Baghdad, because there was basically just me and a colleague, and it gave time to kind of reflect on it. It was, we each had a bottle of champagne, Wheat Thins, and we listened to a tribute to Merle Haggard. So it was a nice way to take it all in.
Now, you said that when you won the Pulitzer, you were staying at the Sheraton because you had to leave your house due to security concerns. But I thought the hotels were supposed to be the real scary places, and that the reporters were all leaving the hotels and going to houses.
Yeah, there's not a lot of safe places in Baghdad right now. Probably people are leaving houses to come into the hotels, just because the Sheraton and the Palestine, the two very large hotels near the Tigris in Baghdad, have the best security. They're pretty fortified compounds. And I think there's a downside to that, and that you're isolated. And I think that's going to be a bigger concern as the months pass for journalists, is that isolation from the rest of the city. But I think, given what a lot of TV and newspapers have faced so far, and their compounds being scouted, threats being made to the residents, there's not a lot of alternatives at this point.
Is it hard for reporters to get out of their hotel room or their house to go and report because it's so dangerous?
It's becoming more and more difficult. And I think, it was interesting. I had gone down to a city in southern Iraq probably 2 or 3 weeks ago now, a town called Nasiriyah. And I'd been there several times. I didn't think twice about going down there. I found a pretty easy place to report in a lot of ways. I went down there, I guess this was 2 or 3 weeks ago, and 2 days earlier somebody had been kidnapped, a British contractor. That night shelling started between Italian forces and Sadr. And the next morning I woke up with my driver, and we just, made the decision to leave as soon as possible. There's a real insecurity that lurks there right now, and I think it's even more pronounced in Baghdad. You can still get around the city. There's no problem driving around it. It's just you worry about being singled out or being followed. But beyond Baghdad, it's very tough right now. It's very difficult. I think the roads around the city are almost too dangerous to travel on. And even inside Baghdad, you do think twice now. And there's a lot more reservations you'd have now than you would have, say, 2 or 3 months ago.
Was there a turning point during your time in Iraq where you felt you started to see popular opinion in Iraq really turn against the United States?
You know, I think it's been the toughest challenge in reporting in Iraq since the beginning, since before the war, was trying to get at unvarnished opinions or real sentiments. And it was a challenge I put ahead of myself during the war, is, you know, trying to get away from the minders, trying to get away from the governments, understand what people were really thinking. And I think what I came away from during the war was that it was incredibly complex. I mean, these were, you know, I've always thought about Iraq is that they're living a lifetime in the span of months. And that's, I think, overwhelming in a lot of respects. To me, where you did see that complexity, I mean, if you do accept the idea that the sentiments are incredibly complex and you can have people welcoming the Americans at the same time as resenting the idea of an occupation, and being anxious over the future and being glad that Saddam is gone, all these things coming together at once, I do think that you saw a real shift in opinion. And I look back to those first 2 or 3 weeks after the war as really kind of setting the direction of the way the aftermath unfolded. And those, I think those 2 or 3 weeks were critical. What you had were people overwhelmed in every respect by what the U.S. military represented. This war was prosecuted, even in their eyes, very, you know, brilliantly. It was devastating. It was precise. It was a technological prowess that I think nobody really understood before the war. And there was this expectation that followed that that it would be as sophisticated when the aftermath occurred, and it wasn't. And you saw in those first couple of weeks looting that destroyed Baghdad far more than the war itself did. I think you saw the oil ministry defended before other government buildings were, and it created those suspicions and created those a certain level of disillusionment that's only intensified since then. I think when you look at Iraq today, it borders on paranoia, what people think of U.S. intentions and U.S. policy, and it's really disturbing to see how that's basically escalated since the beginning.
In September, you spoke with the family of a, quote, martyr who gave his life in fighting the American occupation. His name was Adnan Fadawi. What did he do?
Well, I was trying to understand the motivations of people who were fighting the U.S. occupation at that point. And the insurgency was, or the guerrilla campaign, however you want to describe it, was, I think, most intense in this area, is west of Baghdad, north of Baghdad. So I went out to a town called Khadiyah, and he was one of five people who were killed. I think it was five who were killed. And basically what in reflection was probably just a suicide mission. He was turned into a martyr by the town. His poster was, I found actually, found out about him by visiting a barber shop and seeing his picture pasted on the window there. And as a reporter, I wanted to just understand who he was and what he was trying to do. And really the way to do that, since they were all dead, was to go back to their families. And again, families are nervous. They're not sure who you are. But I tried to reconstruct as much as possible why these people did what they did. And I was struck at the time. This was quite a while ago. But I was struck at the time by how much they were driven by religion and a sense of religion and land that was very disassociated from Saddam. These people weren't remnants of the Ba'ath Party, remnants of Saddam's government. They said they were fighting in the name of Islam, and you know, you kind of have to take that at face value that what they're telling you is true. But I do remember a conversation with, I think it was his brother or it was another one of their brothers, sitting alone in a room. His father had told him not to speak to us, but he really wanted to say something. And he gave this searing critique of Saddam Hussein that could have come out of any U.S. official, basically. I mean, what Saddam had done to the country. But at the same time, he saw what was going on in his city as an occupation, and he almost saw a religious duty to fight it. Now, I don't think that's representative. I don't think it's representative even of that town. But it did strike me, those words from an 18 or 19-year-old who began to espouse a justification for fighting that probably wasn't there even a few months before that.
The young man who I mentioned, who was on this suicide mission and was killed in the attack, and his brother said that this young man preferred to be a martyr rather than to marry. It's a difficult thing to conceive of for most of us.
I think that's true, and I think, you know, when you try to grasp the depth of religious feelings, especially in more conservative and tribal areas like Khadiyah is out in the west, it's striking. One thing that struck me about Iraq, I think, and it really struck me in reporting that story, was that I think Iraq, especially in Washington, has often been described, or the war, or the aftermath, the occupation, has often been put in terms of creating a country, creating a new Iraq that will in turn change the rest of the Arab world. And I guess what struck me in reporting over the past several months is that how much the rest of the Arab world has changed Iraq. And when I was talking to the families of these guys who were killed, you heard who they're listening to. They're listening to Islamic preachers, quite militant preachers that had had followings in Syria, had followings in Egypt. And some of these names I hadn't seen since I'd been reporting in Cairo 10 years ago, but they'd begun entering the country. Sheikh Kishk was one, a very well-known Egyptian preacher who probably had never been heard in Iraq before the fall of Saddam Hussein, but was now one of the more popular cassettes or CDs that were selling there. I mean, there was definitely an Islamist kind of religious discourse that gets blended with a certain nationalism, a certain devotion to land, hostility to the West, a hostility to occupation that you see all kind of mixing up, especially in these areas out west and north of Baghdad in the Sunni areas. And I think it's, I guess what strikes me the most about it is how distinct it is from loyalty to Saddam on one hand, and on the other hand, how difficult it is, I think, contest if you're the U.S. administration there.
Do you know how these radical clerics from other countries have managed to so quickly establish a following in Iraq?
You know, it's actually the tapes are very cheap, or the CDs. They're usually CDs that are sold. And they come across the borders, and then they're copied and recopied and copied again. I think they sell for 15 cents, if I recall, 20 cents. When you watch these tapes, I mean, as disturbing as the message might be, these people are remarkable orators. Kishk is known throughout the Arab world for his, this booming kind of stentorian voice, a voice that got him in a lot of trouble in Egypt. He was in prison several times before he died in the mid-90s. I think a lot of these guys, they're kind of taken by the newness of it or the novelty of it, and it's a message that, can cross borders in a lot of ways. It is a very... very religious message, but it's also a very politicized message, and that is hostility to the West, to Israel, to the U.S., and to what they see as their policies in the region.
Were these tapes not allowed into Iraq or not allowed to be sold on the streets during the Saddam Hussein regime?
No, definitely. There was, Saddam was threatened as much by Islamists as he was by other forms of opposition, and you could probably get them underground, but you'd have to go to great lengths to find them, and the risks of being found with them, jail would probably be the best thing that could happen to you. So there has been a flourishing in a way in these towns, but in Baghdad as well, of finding everything that was once illicit, things that we would find familiar and things that we find less familiar, like, for instance, the tapes of Kishk.
Now, I mean, it's a good example of how freedom of speech in Iraq has resulted in some instances in the kind of demagogic and frightening speech that, isn't exactly what the American administration had in mind.
No, I think, as someone who's reported in the Arab world for 10 years now, it's remarkable. I mean, it is remarkable that, what you do have in Iraq today is, with exceptions, I mean, the administration there has closed down newspapers and the Arab networks have had trouble there, but there really is a flourishing of voices and sentiments, some that would not be seen as pro-American, some that, would be. But it's arguably, one of the most, I think, in terms of freedom of expression or getting your hands on anything you want to, probably one of the freest places in the region right now.
Well, give us the flip side of that coin. What are some of the exciting examples of free speech that you saw or heard in Iraq?
Well, I think there's no question there's been a real flourishing of media. I mean, anybody who has enough money can put out a newspaper, and you've dozens of them, scores of them right now in Baghdad. Not all that well read, but I mean, there's a media scene that I think is probably unmatched anywhere but Lebanon, maybe. And it probably outdoes Lebanon at this point, just in terms of the diversity and the number of voices out there. At the same time, with the media scene, you do have a sense of freedom in organizing. And I think the people who've most capitalized on that are the clergy, the Shiite clergy, who have gone to remarkable lengths to try to organize followers, to try to set up what we would describe as civil society groups in a lot of ways at a very local neighborhood level. Now, this isn't what I think the U.S. administration envisioned as a secular democratic civil society, but it is a civil society in a lot of respects, and it's having an effect on the place. You're seeing political campaigns start to emerge. You're seeing petition drives, things that have, probably never happened in Iraq before. It's probably not the people we expected to carry them out, but it is remarkable that it's happening.
My guest is Anthony Shadid. Earlier this month, he won the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting for his articles in the Washington Post on the war in Iraq and its aftermath. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Anthony Shadid. He's the Islamic Affairs Correspondent for The Washington Post. He has reported from Iraq since before the war, and he just came back from Iraq about a week ago to begin writing a book. And in April, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting from Iraq. In August, you reported on the story of a father who was basically forced by his villagers to kill his own son. Would you tell us that story?
Yeah, to this day, that story remains the most disturbing that I wrote. I mean, when I read it over, it still kind of chills me. This was a town north of Baghdad, a place called Dulariya, probably about an hour north of Baghdad along the Tigris. And I had been there early on, soon after the war. There had been a U.S. military crackdown on the village. And during the crackdown, the military had used an Iraqi informer to help identify people they saw as they considered ex-Baathists or people who were carrying out attacks on U.S. forces. And this guy's identity was known to the village. Even at that point, they recognized his voice, his walk. And I wondered what was going to happen to that informer, and I kind of tried to keep tabs on it. And they'd gone back to the village several times. I guess it was probably about 3 months later when I went back, I learned that he had been killed. And what had happened was the village blamed him, or several people in the village had blamed him for the deaths of three men during the U.S. crackdown on the town. And the families of those people killed delivered a very blunt warning to the informer's father, and that was either he killed his son or they would kill his family. And the father was faced with that choice, and I remember speaking to him when we were in his house, and and I was reluctant to even bring it up. I knew, however I said it, it was going to sound bad. And after probably a half hour of sitting there drinking tea, we finally started talking about what had happened. And he was still numb at that point. This is several weeks after it had happened. And I remember he turned to me and he said, "Not even the prophet Abraham had to kill his son." And those words still chill me. I think right then you understood the enormity of what the choice you face. And, right or wrong, the choice that he had is, I guess, a choice that probably none of us would ever even have to come close to.
If the villagers wanted this young man dead because they felt that he was a traitor, why didn't they kill him himself? Why did they force his own father to kill him? That seems like a very sadistic thing to do.
It does, and that's the way I read it when I first heard about it. I thought it was just this village, making a point that this is what happens to an informer. But, after reporting the story, you learn that it was very mixed up into tribal justice and, centuries-old tribal justice. And for other villagers to kill his son would then create another vendetta, which would have to play out again, and it would lead to another killing and then another killing as the vendettas played out. For the father to kill his son, the vendettas would end there. In other words, there would be no more retribution after that, and that's what the people in the village who insisted on that that's what they were doing. They didn't want this to go beyond what had already gone to.
Then did the father have to decide what means he was going to use to kill his own son?
My understanding was that they delivered the warning to him, and then they expected him to act. And it was he and his other son who killed Sabah. They shot him, and. It's a very disturbing story. I mean, the father shot him, and he didn't die, and he couldn't finish what he'd begun. And so Sabah's brother fired the shots that killed him.
What reaction did you get to this story?
I thought that story probably generated more of a response than any other story I wrote, I think. I think it just chilled people to such a to such a degree, you know, that choice. I mean, it is. It was a biblical choice. I mean, when he said that to me, not even the prophet Abraham had to kill his son. I mean, it's a choice that I've never imagined and never could imagine. And it shows the complexity of Iraq. I mean, here, you know, tribal justice mixed up with the occupation, mixed up with traditions, and you know, a certain violence that lurks underneath the surface in Iraq. I think a violence that's far greater than other Arab countries that I've been to. You know, I think even as a reporter, it's kind of hard to grasp the, you know, what the society is all about.
Here's one of the things that makes me think about. The United States is supposed to be giving Iraq sovereignty at the end of June. Now, if this is an example of tribal justice, this situation where the father was forced to kill his own son, there's such a big distance between that type of local tribal justice and the concept of that and the kind of democracy that the Bush administration had in mind when it began this war. I mean, how do you get from that notion of tribal justice to Western-style democracy?
Well, I think it's a good question. And I mean, that's, you know, I don't think this would have happened in Deloria if it hadn't been for the collapse of authority, basically. I mean, I think in a lot of those areas, when the government collapsed, more traditional forms of justice or enforcement or whatever, however you want to describe it, emerged. And, you know, in that vacuum, tribal justice became much more common in some of the areas north and west of Baghdad. You know, security is preeminent here, and as long as there's not security in Iraq, there's going to be unrest, there's going to be conflict, there's going to be a lot of trouble. And I think the U.S. administration actually understands that the political project they envisioned takes a back seat to the security situation. And I think to me the question, you know, as a journalist watching this unfold, is can they guarantee security to let these other things, you know, possibly come forth? You know, I think most Iraqis do want a democratic state. They do want freedoms enshrined that they've enjoyed for the past several months. But I think even more than that, they want better lives, you know, from an economic standpoint, and they want to feel safe. And I think if you ask a lot of people right now what are their biggest priorities, that is, it's feeling safe and being better off than they have been.
Anthony Shadid is the Islamic affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. He won this year's Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by TIAA Craft, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide, TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more about covering Iraq with Anthony Shadid, winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting. We'll also hear the story of how he was shot in 2002 while covering the Israeli occupation of the West Bank town of Ramallah. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews A Song I Knew by Heart, the new novel by Brett Lott.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Anthony Shadid. Earlier this month, he won the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting for his articles about the war in Iraq and its aftermath. Shadid is the Islamic Affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. He returned home from Iraq last week to begin a 6-month leave of absence, during which he intends to write a book about Iraq. He's also the author of a book first published in 2001 called Legacy of the Prophet, Despots, Democrats, and the New Politics of Islam. When you look ahead to the end of June, what are some of the possible scenarios that you see as the United States and the coalition hand sovereignty to Iraq and the UN most likely steps in to play a larger role?
I think this date of June 30th is going to be probably more important to the Bush administration than it is going to be to Iraqis. I mean, you are going to have, you know, a form of sovereignty take place. How you define that sovereignty is going to be a big question. I mean, I'm sure there'll be debates over what that sovereignty actually is. I don't think a lot of Iraqis are going to see it as a huge change in what's already been going on. I think a lot of people are going to look toward the U.S. embassy as the real power in the country, and they're going to realize that you've got more than 100,000 troops there, and that they remain in charge. I think that creates a lot of challenges for the U.S. administration. One, how do they create or how do they give credibility or legitimacy to this government that they set up after June 30th? And how do they avoid getting the blame for everything that goes wrong after that as well? You know, something that's always struck me is that when people refer to the war that overthrew Saddam, they use a word in Arabic that means collapse. And it's always struck me is that, you know, the idea of collapse, that something ended and something has yet to begin. And I think that's what's really been kind of overshadowed a lot of the political processes unfolded over the past year is, you know, how do you begin something anew? And there is this idea of legitimacy, and it means a lot in Iraq. It's tinged with kind of a religious connotation. And, you know, I think more often than not, it's much easier to deny than it is to bestow on things. And I wonder how they do bring about that legitimacy, as long as you do have a U.S. presence there that is so large and so influential. How does a government actually prove that it's speaking on behalf of Iraqis and not on behalf of U.S. interests there?
So you're concerned that the Iraqi government might be seen as a puppet government?
I think that's definitely a concern. On the other hand, if that government does deliver, if it restores security, if it improves lives in Iraq, if the economy is better off, that may be okay. People may accept the fact that it's going to be influenced very decisively by the U.S. administration, but the trade-off is that, you know, they're better off than they were today or 3 months ago or 6 months ago.
The Bush administration says it wants to place certain limits on Iraq's sovereignty, including that Iraq would only have partial command over its armed forces and no authority to enact new laws. What are the ways that might affect how the government is seen?
Exactly. I mean, that's the precise point right there is that I think sovereignty is going to be, I think it's going to be more of a message received in Washington than it is in Baghdad. In other words, I think the Bush administration can describe what's happening as a transit, that the occupation is ending. And the occupation is an explosive war, and I think that will actually have an impact in Iraq, that the occupation itself is over. But I think people in Baghdad and in much of Iraq are going to see sovereignty. This is much more process than change. In other words, that what would they've been? Bremer's gone. The ambassador will be there, and the ambassador will still be the final word on a lot of issues.
Do you think that the United Nations is or could be more popular in Iraq than the United States?
Well, I think it could be, and I think that's this again. It goes to this question of legitimacy and how do you bring about legitimacy for an Iraqi government, for Iraqi security forces, even. And I think the UN does have at least an image or a reputation of being somewhat more independent, that the UN doesn't have its own interests as a superpower inside Iraq. And you do hear people calling for the UN to take a greater role, that what the UN delivers would maybe have an easier time at getting credibility or legitimacy in the eyes of many people. Now, you already do hear from some senior Shiite clerics, for instance, this idea that the UN is doing the U.S. bidding in Iraq right now. So, I mean, there are risks to navigate there, but I think there's no question that the U.N. is going to have an easier time than the U.S. in trying to create a new government there.
You speak Arabic, which most of the American correspondents in Iraq do not do. What are some of the advantages that it gave you?
You know, I think it especially was helpful during the war. When if I was going to get away from my minder during the war, the escort that the government sends with the reporters, you'd have to speak. I mean, most people use their minder as a translator. You had to use your minder as a translator. And there were several instances where I had a minder that was cooperative, and he looked the other way as I went off by myself to speak with families or to try to do some interviews that, you know, in hopes of getting some kind of unvarnished opinion. I think that was where it was most effective, just in the day-to-day work, that I was able to work on my own and not have to worry about bringing people along with me. I think since then, and it's difficult to say because, you know, I have worked in places like Iran and Turkey with a translator, and I don't feel like it's qualitatively changed the work. I think in some situations it does create an element of trust that's often difficult to get in interviews and to speak the same language. There's kind of it suggests also like a shared, I don't know, how would you say it, like a shared memory, historical memory, shared culture. I mean, to me, the language was most useful in the kind of texture of a story, that a phrase you would hear, you'd understand what that phrase, you know, that it meant something different, perhaps, in Arabic than it would in English in a literal translation. Not necessarily the essence of the story, but the decoration around it. I mean, that's to me where language became so effective, is that you did understand a context and perhaps a different meaning, perhaps a different inflection on it. And I think that often helped to write the stories.
I remember shortly after the war, Tom Ricks, who writes about the military for your paper, The Washington Post, was on our show. And he was telling the story about how one day you and he were working together, and he was interviewing American troops. And as they were passing through a city, and then you would be like a block or two behind, and then you would interview Iraqi residents. And the story that Tom Ricks was getting from the American troops about how things were going was completely different from the story you were getting from Iraqi people about how they thought the war was going and how they perceived the American military. The American military seemed to think that that the Iraqi people were very happy to see them. You were getting a lot more skepticism from the Iraqi people. What did that say to you about either the American military or the Iraqi people or reporting?
Well, you know, it struck me, and it struck Tom as well. You know, it was still very early on to the early into the aftermath, and you heard, like, you know, like I've always said, you heard sentiments all over the map. You heard people saw them as liberators. You heard people that were, you know, hoping that they were going to bring improvement in lives. But you also heard very clearly and very distinctly unease about the occupation. And again, this was early on. This is before the guerrilla campaign or insurgency, or however you want to describe it, really went into full force. But I think both Tom and I understood at that point, and it's not what we expected, but we understood the depth of unease about the idea of occupation, what it means to pride, what it means to dignity, nationalism, national honor, however you want to describe it. But it really struck us, the forcefulness of those opinions that were elaborate on that day. And we had one of those odd moments where the soldiers had gone into an orphanage at the time, to try to like create connections with the community, to try to, you know, I think they just saw it as, you know, as kind of canvassing, basically. And of course they went and they saw their work as they should, as, you know, something really rewarding. And then as I was interviewing kind of these young guys outside, they thought the guys were going in there to molest the children. I mean, it was just such a stark difference in perceptions over what they were trying to do there.
My guest is Anthony Shadid. Earlier this month, he won the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting for his articles in The Washington Post on the war in Iraq and its aftermath. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Anthony Shadid. He's the Islamic Affairs Correspondent for The Washington Post. This month, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his international reporting, his reporting from Iraq. And he started reporting from there before the war and continued through the aftermath until about a week ago. A couple of years ago, you were actually shot in the line of reporting. You were reporting on the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. You were in Ramallah. And you were shot. To your knowledge, what happened?
Well, I was walking back from Arafat's compound in Ramallah after just it had been a long day of reporting. I was going back to the hotel room to write a story. I was with a friend, and we were walking down the middle of the street. I thought being in the middle of the street would make it safer, that it wouldn't seem like we were trying to hide or lurk behind buildings or anything like that. It was an area that was very well controlled. I mean, the Israeli army was out in force all around Arafat's compound. There were checkpoints down the road, and there were snipers on the buildings, and it was one shot that was fired. I didn't see who shot me, but I have a little doubt in my mind that that it was the Israeli army, or it was an Israeli sniper that did it. If a shot had come from a Palestinian at that point, it would have the building wouldn't have been standing minutes later. Once I fell to the ground, I thought it was a stun grenade at first because the bullet had passed so close to my spine that I think for a few seconds it had paralyzed me. And then when I was able to move again, I reached behind my flak jacket and saw that I had been hurt. And so the guy was with me, lifted me up, and we walked a few steps. And it was kind of tough going there for a little while. And then we finally got to an Israeli checkpoint that was probably about 50 yards away. And to their credit, they delivered first aid, bandaged it, and then I was taken to a Palestinian hospital a few minutes later.
So it wasn't until you saw the blood that you realized you were actually hit by a bullet?
Yeah, I felt the pain on my spine. I said, "Said, I think I was shot," and he was patting my body, and he said he didn't see anything. And then when I reached behind the flak jacket and I pulled my hand out, it was, you know, I could see the blood. And we sat there for, you know, those are the kind of moments where you don't know, I didn't know what had happened. I didn't know where the bullet was. And we sat in the middle of the street, which was deserted, and it was a very cloudy day, it was a very gray sky. And we sat on our cell phones trying to call the hospital we were just at to get an ambulance, but cell phones were jammed. And, you know, it's very unnerving because you feel very alone in those kind of instances. And, you realize how close death can be.
So what was the damage that was done?
Yeah, I'm incredibly lucky. It had entered my left shoulder and then exited the right shoulder. And it knocked off the tip of this is what they call a spinous process, but it didn't hit the spinal cord. So I have some muscle damage in my right shoulder, but nothing debilitating. I mean, I'm incredibly lucky for what actually happened.
Went from one side of your body through the other?
I mean, it passed right along the back. It's remarkable when you see the trajectory. It actually bounced. I'm not a doctor, but this is what I was told. It deflected just barely off the scapula, and so it aimed upwards, and so it was able to exit the body without going deeper, and that's what saved my life.
Huh. Did you ever talk to the Israeli government about what happened, since you feel confident that it was an Israeli soldier's bullet that hit you?
We did. The Boston Globe was actually, I was working at the Boston Globe at the time, and they were very they were very good about it. We filed a complaint with the IDF asking for an investigation. And I think I heard back when I was in Baghdad during the war. And the final result of the investigation was that they couldn't determine who shot me, whether it was Israeli or Palestinian. And, you know, to be honest, at this point, I don't see much of a need. I don't know what could be done by following up anymore.
I'm interested in the fact that you decided to go back into war reporting after that.
Well, I haven't been back to the West Bank.
No, but you were in Iraq, which is probably a lot more dangerous.
Yeah.
You were there during the bombing, and then you were there during, you know, the post-war, like the post-war violence up until a week ago.
Yeah. I might change my opinion after the last month. And there have been instances where journalists have been shot, but West Bank still, to me, remains one of the most dangerous places on earth for a journalist. And, mm-hmm. and you can see the number of journalists that have been shot and killed there. You know, Baghdad has become a much more unpredictable place the past month. And so, you know, last year I would have said I still thought the West Bank was more dangerous, but now I think Baghdad is becoming so, you know, like I said, so unpredictable, and you just don't know where the threat lurks or where the danger is coming from, that it's rough. You know, looking back, it was a decision that you had to make on whether to, you know, stay during the war. And, you know, I don't think this job is worth dying for by any means at all. In fact, I don't want to get hurt again, but I do think there are certain stories that are important enough that you do need to take, I guess that you have to take some risks. And, you know, I think it would have been a tragedy for a newspaper like the Washington Post not to have somebody in Baghdad. Just as it would have been a tragedy for us not to have been embedded with the U.S. military throughout the country or having somebody in Washington covering that. I mean, it was one part of the story. And the more eyes and ears you have on the ground, the more accurate picture, the more complete picture you get of what's going on.
Well, let me ask you what you learned from covering the Middle East that helped you understand what has been happening in Iraq. You know, in other words, if you're covering Israel and the occupied territories, has informed the way you see what's happening in Iraq?
Well, I think you understand. I mean, I guess what struck me about Iraq, and this is something that I thought about kind of early on, even when I was there during the war, is that Iraq is very much an Arab country. And while it's been isolated from the rest of the region for years, more than a decade, it remains an Arab country. And I think, that can sound superficial. I don't mean it that way, but you can read certain things into that, that the history of the region, that the culture of the region, that, you know, attitudes toward U.S. policy or suspicion of U.S. policy, how closely people watch the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, all these things play in Iraq just the way they play in Egypt, definitely to different degrees. I mean, there are different societies, and there are different histories there, but there is a certain similarity. And I, you know, the longer I'm in Baghdad, and as I said earlier, I think, you know, it strikes me how much the rest of the Arab world is affecting Iraq. The longer I'm in Baghdad, the more familiar it feels to me in the way that Cairo did, say, you know, as a reporter there in the late 90s. You hear things that are similar. You hear sentiments that are similar. It's, you know, in a way, and kind of an unusual way, it's becoming very integrated into the attitudes and sentiments that are coursing through the rest of the region.
A couple of years ago, you wrote a book called Legacy of the Prophet, Despots, Democrats, and the New Politics of Islam. You said, "My concern is democracy, and more specifically, a transformation that I believe is underway across the heart of the Muslim world in both the style and the message of Islamic politics." And you wrote about a new generation of Islamic leaders that were finding a more realistic and potentially more successful future through democratic politics. Do you still feel that way, seeing what's like the radicalization that's happening now in Iraq?
I do. I think that the generation still is there, and I think that generation is probably the best hope for the region. You see them in Egypt, you see them in Turkey, you see them in a few other countries in the region. You know, I guess if I made one caution about that now, is that I think September 11th and the war in Iraq have, like you pointed out, so radicalized the region that I think it's going to take many more years for those voices to maybe even reach the level that they had before September 11th. But there is that fundamental question of democracy and political Islam and how you reconcile that question, because I think there is very much a push for democratic reform in the region. And I think most people who live in the region understand that democratic reform would often play into the hands of Islamists, that they at this point have maybe not a majority of support, but a plurality of support in a lot of countries. And how do you reconcile that? How do you reconcile democracy with political Islam? And is there a way to reconcile them? And that's what struck me about the activists that I wrote the book on, that generation of activists, was that they very much thought you could reconcile them, that they saw a certain plurality in democratic politics and in their own movement, you know, the ability to create coalitions, to work with secular activists. And most importantly, they saw that what their political program was not the only program that was acceptable. I mean, this is what you saw a generation ago with a lot of Islamic activists, that their program was the only one that could exist. Anybody who was against it was un-Islamic. And I think you've seen kind of a certain maturity among some activists away from that in any one vision there can be very, you know, several competing voices.
You left Iraq a week ago. And now you're going to take 6 months off from writing for the Washington Post so that you could write a book. Did you have this timed before you won the Pulitzer? Did you know that you were going to be leaving?
I did. I was supposed to leave April 1st, but the story became so dramatic that I ended up staying on for a couple more weeks. But I was planning to leave around April.
So now you take 6 months off to write your book. Do you think you'll go back into a war zone afterwards?
Well, I'll go back to Baghdad. I plan to, at least for 6 months. We'll see how long, long I stay. But I'm actually looking forward to getting back. I've covered the region for quite a while, and I'm always struck by how the story plays out in Iraq. I mean, these, you know, arcs of religion, of sentiments, of social forces, of economic, I mean, you know, processes that played out over years in a lot of other countries in the region play out in months in Iraq, and it's dramatic and it's breathtaking. And I think, you know, a generation from now, we're going to look back at this past year and possibly the year ahead and realize that unless we understood that, we're not going to understand what this region looks like, you know, a generation from now. You do feel the gravity of the story.
And you're not worried about getting soft, so to speak, in the 6 months that you're out of Iraq?
You know, I hate to say this with all my colleagues still in Baghdad, but I'm actually looking forward to a break. This has been a long year.
I can imagine that. How could you not be?
Yeah, I do feel uncomfortable not being there for what I think could be a very dramatic and decisive time. But, you know, I also have the sense that it's going to remain dramatic in a lot of ways for a long time. So that it'll be good to maybe take a step back and then go back in, you know, with eyes a little clearer.
Well, Anthony Shadid, congratulations again on your Pulitzer Prize. And good luck with the book that you're about to start. And thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Anthony Shadid is the Islamic Affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. He won this year's Pulitzer Prize for international reporting. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Brett Lott's new novel, A Song I Knew by Heart. This is Fresh Air. Brett Lott's novel, Jewel, was chosen as an Oprah Book Club selection in 1999. He's known for telling old-fashioned stories about faith and family bonds. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says Lott's latest novel, A Song I Knew by Heart, is also a literary vacation from postmodern cynicism, but she doesn't think she could live in this world permanently.
Brett Lott's new novel, A Song I Knew by Heart, firmly demarcates its territory at the outset, when our narrator, a 70-something-year-old woman named Naomi, tells us that she's lived in Northampton, Massachusetts for some 40 years and yet has never set foot inside Smith College. Smith was the hub of the town, Naomi admits, the reason we were here, if you read the newspapers the way they wanted you to read them. Smith College was the center of the universe, though it was nothing more than a finishing school for the confused and rich. In contrast, Naomi and her family are rooted in the blue-collar environs surrounding Smith. She was a homemaker, and her husband Eli worked in a garage. Her son Malin drove a food distribution truck for area supermarkets, and her daughter-in-law Ruth is a cashier at the local Stop and Shop. Now, metaphorically speaking, most contemporary novels are written from within the charmed circle of Smith or its like. And they're populated by characters who are literate, self-conscious, ironic, and neurotic, and proud of it. But Lott's novel is atypical, not just because it explores the lives of working-class white characters, but because it's informed by virtues that rarely make it, unedited, into literature anymore. Lott's characters are earnest people who take their families and friends, their jobs and their faith seriously. Pop culture references and glib jokes about Prozac hover at the extreme margins of their world. If, as a reader, you're going to enjoy A Song I Knew by Heart, and there's plenty here to like and even admire, you've got to respect the novel's unapologetic confines. No yearning after the postmodern, the hip, the secular, the other. Smith College is strictly off bounds. I used the past tense a minute ago when describing the jobs held by Naomi's husband and son. That's because they're both dead. Her husband Eli died in his sleep 8 years earlier, and right afterwards Naomi moved in with her son Malin and his wife Ruth. When the novel opens, Malin's funeral has just taken place. A few nights before, he hit a patch of black ice while driving home from visiting a sick friend. He was killed instantly in the crash. The novel's title, A Song I Knew by Heart, refers to the song of grief that Naomi has learned all too well since Eli's death and is now hearing afresh together with the newly widowed Ruth. Reeling from the enormity of her double losses, Naomi decides to return to the town she still regards as home, Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, the place where she grew up and met Eli, the place she left after World War II at the urging of Eli's Navy buddy, who wanted to start a business in Northampton. The surprise here is that when Naomi announces her plan to Ruth, Ruth says, "Where you go, I will go. Where you live, I will live too." If, as a reader, you hear Old Testament echoes in that pronouncement, and of course in Naomi's and Ruth's very names, well, you're most sincerely invited to. One of the things that Lot conveys exquisitely in this novel is the variety of awful ways that grief can hit those left behind. A few weeks after Malin's death, Ruth goes to the movies with a girlfriend, but she runs out of the theater soon after the picture begins. "It was the dark inside the theater," she tells Naomi afterwards, "the way the lights went out and we were all left sitting there watching something going on the wall. It was too much what I've been inside every day so far." Shortly thereafter, Naomi and Ruth set out on their journey, searching for the strong light of the South to heal them. They're enfolded into the warm, but not treacly, extended family of Naomi's stepbrother-in-law. And convincingly, Naomi makes her rocky peace with the God who's taken her husband and son. A Song I Knew by Heart is an affecting novel about the slow workings of forgiveness and redemption. I liked it, but ultimately for my tastes, it's too cloistered off from the all-pervasive influences of modernity, be they destructive or shrill or liberating. After all, even the Pope caved in a few years ago and hosted a Bob Dylan concert at the Vatican.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed A Song I Knew by Heart by Brett Lott. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeldt. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Emery Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Sundance Channel, premiering the weekly original series Anatomy of a Scene with the making of Saved, starring Jenna Malone and Macaulay Culkin, tonight at 9. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, Tina Fey, Saturday Night Live's co-head writer and co-anchor of Weekend Update. She wrote and co-stars in the new movie Mean Girls. Also, we listen back to an interview with Hubert Selby Jr., author of Last Exit to Brooklyn. He died this week at the age of 75. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.